just realized everybody is here to party.
Greetings and welcome, fellow barium intimates, fluoroscopists, and cross table lateralists. I am your host,
Ron Jones,
and I am not a radiology technician. Nope, I'm a technologist, and I've been in this field long enough to know that just because you came into my emergency room at 2 a.m. with a chronic back pain times 6 years does not mean the x-ray should be stat. This is the Radiologic Technologist Podcast for Rad Techs by Rad Techs. Thanks for listening.
Today I'll be talking to Dr. Rebecca Marsh. She is a medical physicist, PhD from University of Texas Houston, recent co-author of the article Patient Shielding and Diagnostic Imaging, Discontinuing a Legacy Practice.
Welcome to the Radiologic Technologist Podcast. I'm Ron Jones, your host, and I'm happy today to have Dr. Rebecca Marsh with us. She is a physicist that's been in the field for quite some time. She has a very extensive background, her PhD in medical physics. She got it back in 2007 from University of Texas and MD Anderson Cancer Center. She studied her master's in physics at University of Texas Houston. She got her bachelor's in physics all the way back in 2000 from the University of Toronto. So she's been in the field a long time. She's has over 17 publications peer-reviewed. I'll just list a few of them. The one that we'll talk about today is the Patient Shielding and Diagnostic Imaging, Discontinuing a Legacy Practice. And that's in the American Journal of, I thought it was American Journal of Radiology, but it says American Journal of Rankinology. So always happy to say Rankinology whenever I can get that one in there. There's the AAPM Medical Physics Practice Guideline, Scope of Practice for Clinical Medical Physics. And there's the Performance Characteristics and Quality Assurance Considerations for Displays Used in Interventional Radiology and Cardiac Catheterization Facilities. So there's 17 total that I found. I'll just stop there, but obviously very affluent in the field of physics. So I'm very grateful to have you with us today to talk about this new initiative to perhaps limit or stop shielding our patients in the world of radiology. So Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. And I appreciate the invitation to be here.
Right. So the giggles there, because this is our second time. I forgot to hit the record button the first time. So we're just kind of starting over. But luckily, we were only about 5 minutes into it. So I did also want to make sure I point out that Rebecca did attend the United States Air Force Academy, because I always like to point out any military involvement. So thank you very much for that. And so we'll just jump into the topic of shield versus not shielding. The AAPM came out with an article not too long ago that stated some basics that we'll get into. But basically they said, you know, the time has come to stop shielding patients. And then the ACR got behind it and said, you know what, you're right, the time has come. I'll throw an early disclaimer in that the ASRT came out, I believe, just yesterday and said, we want to do more research first. But this initiative really makes a lot of sense. And that's why I'm glad we get to talk about this today. And then I do also want to point out that, of course, Rebecca is speaking for herself on her own behalf. She's not here to represent the AAPM or the ACR or the ASRT. She's just giving us her insights from her extensive physics background on what all this means, kind of where it came from. So that is kind of one of the top questions that I see in the Facebook groups for radiographers. And that is that they're curious how the acquired data, where the data came from to kind of start this conversation. Maybe we'll start there.
So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk. So this really came out of some discussions that we had at our local hospital. So, you know, I work at University of Colorado Hospital, and a couple of years ago, I was approached by some of our technologists, and they had questions about the best way to provide shielding for our NICU patients. And we sat down and I talked, there were some our radiography manager and some rad techs and some of the folks from the NICU. And I sat down and we discussed it. And I said, well, really, there are risks involved with shielding these NICU patients. And my professional opinion is that we'd actually be better off not shielding them at all. And we discussed it and everybody in that room said, okay, well, that makes sense. And I'm one of these people who I may reason through something, but I want to be able to get the idea out there and have other people comment on things that I may have missed, things I haven't considered. And essentially I want people to prove me wrong in a way. And so at the next AAPM national meeting, which was in Nashville, I think it was in Nashville, I approached many, many medical physicists. And I had talked to I'd reached out to people across the country, medical physicists across the country too, and said, hey, this is kind of the discussion I've had. Is there something I'm missing? Is there something that I should be considering that I'm not? And had a lot more of those conversations during this annual meeting in Nashville. And the response that I got from 100% of the medical physicists that I talked to, well, I'll say 99, I don't know. I can't swear by 100%, by the overwhelming majority of medical physicists was, there's no reason to do it, but we do it because that's the way it's always been done. And I thought, well, that's interesting. If the medical physics community agrees that there's no reason to continue doing this and that it introduces additional risk of not getting a good image the first time we're taking it, then maybe we should do something about it. And I approached AAPM and I said, hey, if an AAPM member has an idea for a position statement, task group, how does that process work? And that started the whole process. But I was surprised at just the response that I got from the medical physics community was really, yeah, we know it doesn't do any good. And we know that there are these potential problems, but good luck trying to do anything about it. I mean, quite honestly, that was the response I got. And I said, okay, well, if there's agreement that this is the right thing to do is to limit how we're using patient shielding, then let's not give, you know, why don't we give it a shot? Let's open up the conversation. And that's really how the AAPM position statement came to be. It went through multiple approval processes from different groups within AAPM. And I think that when I counted, it was officially approved and voted on by over 50 imaging physicists and the AAPM board of directors. So there really was consensus. And there was some disagreement about exact wording and things like that. But that's really how it came to be. And our motivation, and I want to kind of say this from the start, I know that there's some disagreements about this particular topic. I also know that everybody who is involved in this conversation has patients' interests at heart, the patient's best interests at heart.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to do what's best for patient safety. We just have some slight disagreements about what that is. And when that paper initially came out, the one that you mentioned from AJR, there were comments along the lines of, well, they obviously don't care about patients. They obviously, you know, haven't spent any time in the clinic. And in some ways, the second comment was justified because the technologists obviously spend a lot more time in the clinic than I do and than most medical physicists.
Right.
I will say, however, that so you mentioned my graduate work. I did spend 2 years after that doing a clinical medical physics residency where the entire goal is to give us experience in the clinic. And so it's not that I'm completely unfamiliar with that environment.
Sure.
But I think that sometimes there's this vision that physicists sit in an office and never set foot in a clinic and are completely unaware of any of that, the clinical aspect of things. And I think that it's important that we engage with each other, the technologists and the physics community, communicate adequately so that we can share what those experiences and knowledge are. Because obviously I don't spend all day, every day interacting with patients. And so getting that feedback and getting input from the radiology technologist community is critical for anything like this.
Excellent. That's exactly what this is about, is I'm a tech asking you where did this come from and what's going on, and sharing some questions that I've garnered from some groups of techs on Facebook. It's great that they are willing to listen and take it on, because I know one of the first things I've seen in the field after seeing some of this initiative is a lot of techs were like, whoa, 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 we've been shielding our whole career. This flies against everything we ever taught about keeping our patients safe. And it definitely caught the attention of a lot of people. I will say that there are reports in these groups that there are facilities already making this a policy change to start taking this stance of shielding less. Maybe what we start with is if I understood the initiative, there's really kind of three basic things it hinges on. One being that the technology has come such a long way since the 1970s that the dose has been reduced on one paper that I read by about 96%. So our technology has come so far that we're barely given any dose at all anymore, thanks to the new equipment. The second arm of this, if you will, is that when you are shielding our new fancy equipment with its automatic exposure control, I want to say when it was designed to help determine the tissue thickness, so that if you were, you know, if you do an X-ray of a hip on a thinner patient, it doesn't require as much energy to get through that patient. But if you're imaging a larger patient, the AEC is detecting that thicker tissue, and it's amping up the energy a little bit to punch through that tissue. And so when the AEC detects the SLED shield, it's detecting something dense in the field of view. So it's amping up the energy, meaning that shield still protected, say, the gonads that it was laid on top of, but the area around that is now getting more dose because the AEC picked up that shield and increase the output. So that's kind of the second concern. And then the third concern, I believe I read in a paper that a study was done on how many times films had to be repeated, because when that shield was used, it accidentally covered up some anatomy and that patient's exam had to be repeated. So we have three real distinct reasons to stop building, at least as we're doing it today. So maybe you could talk a little bit about and if I missed anything, let me know, but maybe you can talk a little bit about those three points.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that there really is, the way that I like to think of it is we talk about risk benefit all the time in medicine and in diagnostic imaging. And I think that it's important to go back also and remember why patient shielding really was introduced. And I think that most people know that it's currently, or in 1976, it was introduced as gonadal shielding was introduced as a suggestion into the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations by the FDA. And the only concern that they cited, their only justification for doing it, was to, out of an abundance of caution, to help protect against genetic or hereditary effects. And even the FDA has recently proposed removing that from the Code of Federal Regulations, saying that it's obsolete. And since that time, we have much more information about, you know, atomic bomb survivor and these long-term survival studies, and there just hasn't been any evidence that hereditary risks are an issue, even at much, much higher radiation doses. So in terms of potential benefits from shielding, that's a big one, that there's no evidence that there is any benefit, because there's no evidence that there's any risk. I think that in terms of benefit to the patient, between what you mentioned, doses are much, much lower, and there's no evidence of hereditary risks, and there's no evidence of fetal risks below about 50 milligray. And so there really isn't a health benefit to these patients to providing them with shielding. Then if we look at the risks introduced by shielding, then we have what you mentioned, AEC. And personally, I think the bigger risk is obscured anatomy. And there are a number of publications that, starting from 1992, going until just this last year, documenting people who have gone through and looked at radiographs, and specifically pelvic radiographs, and looked at the rate of mispositioned shielding. And it's sometimes as high as 90% for females. But what's surprising is even for males, it's some of these studies cite mispositioning rates of 50-60%. And that's a significant amount. Now, in their images, radiographs where the relevant anatomy is obscured is still fairly high. It's still, you know, sometimes 30-40%. And what's even more concerning, in my opinion, is that some of those same studies showed that in very few of those cases where anatomy was obscured, was the image actually repeated. So it's not necessarily that we're leading to more repeated exams, which is, of course, a concern. But I think the even bigger concern is when relevant anatomy is covered up by the shielding and those exams are not repeated. Because then what's the point of doing the image in the first place? If we're not getting the anatomical information, that which is the whole goal of taking an X-ray or doing a CT scan in the first place, is to make sure that we're getting anatomical information about that patient that can help guide clinical care. If we've covered up relevant anatomy, we've completely shot ourselves in the foot. I mean, there's no point in having done the image at all. And so that, I think, is the biggest risk, is that a lot of the time anatomy is being covered up and nobody's repeating the image. Now, the other thing that I want to mention is that a comment that I've heard a lot is, oh, well, this happens because technologists are careless. I don't actually think that's the case. And in some of these studies, they actually did retraining and that didn't prove to be effective. And so perhaps you could get the shielding accuracy, so to speak, improve it slightly by increased training. But I think the bigger problem is that a lot of the time it's hard to tell exactly where anatomy is, especially in NICU patients. Some of those male patients, you say, okay, well, it's easier to do gonadal shielding for males. And in general, that's true. But if you have a patient with undescended testes, which is not uncommon for NICU patients, it makes it very difficult. If you don't have, there's a huge amount of variation in where the ovaries are located in females. And it's very, very difficult to place shielding so that it's both effective in providing protection and not covering up other anatomy. And you also have pediatric patients who move. You have adult patients who move. It's a very, very difficult task. And I guess my position on the matter is that we're almost setting folks up for failure by asking them to do something that's impossible in some situations. And for what? If we're not providing a health benefit for that patient, then why are we doing it at all?
Yep, I totally agree, and that's some great sources there. I did find the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations you're talking about in 1976. In those days, an AP pelvis of a 4-year-old male's testes was registering at approximately 2.5 milligrays. And by 2012, that dose had been reduced to 0.06 milligrays, or the reduction of more than 96% thanks to advances in technology. So that is a significant reduction thanks to the advancement in technology. And like you said as well, they're more interested in the genetic mutation, not necessarily the stochastic effect. So seems to me like they're really more prepared about trying to protect the offspring of that patient. And from what I can tell in my research, we have zero studies that are showing hereditary effects from radiation in humans, right? Did you ever find anything?
No, and that's definitely true. And a lot of the basis for there be a lot of the reason that there was concern about potential hereditary effects in humans was based on fruit fly experiments that were performed in the 1920s and 30s. And it's interesting because actually a lot of those experiments that were done have been heavily criticized from a scientific standpoint. And it's there are several people who have come out and said, hey, I think that a lot of this was oversold. The methodology that was used was never published, which of course is a huge thing for peer-reviewed research if you don't tell anybody how you do the research. And so even that is very questionable. But I think one of the biggest pieces of data that we have, unfortunately, are from atomic bomb survivors. And now we have 80 years, almost 80 years of data to look at. And some of these, a lot of these folks have been very, very closely monitored. And we've learned a fair amount about radiation risk since then. And so the knowledge that we had or the data that we had in 1976 is, well, 50 years, you know, not quite 50 years, maybe, you know, old, but we've been able to observe those people over a much longer period of time. Now, of course, the circumstances are horrible, but that's, in reality, that's where a lot of these data come from.
We need to get around this thing before the likes of Dr. Oz or somebody that's going to run out there and say, you have to shield your patients, you know, or they're going to get negative effects. And so obviously we want to make sure we know exactly what's going on and how we're going to handle it before opposing forces start to chime in, which, you know, maybe it's too late for that. I haven't heard anything other than inside the radiology and physics community. Some of the questions that are coming up on the Facebook group or from other radiographers are around pregnant patients. What are we saying about the pregnant patients?
So the position statement includes doing away with fetal shielding in most circumstances, and I'll get to that clause in just a minute. But it's the same argument. If you have that shielding entering the image, then that can be very problematic. Now, the fetal dose from X-ray exams is very low. And my professional opinion is that we're better off getting the image correct the first time and then taking the risk of getting that shielding in our image and having to repeat it. And this was the other thing that's worth pointing out is that you have to consider where most of the dose to the fetus comes from. If you have there's essentially two scenarios. Either the image has the fetus in the field of view, in which case shielding isn't going to, you don't want to do that anyway, because you're going to be blocking some anatomy. If the fetus is in the field of view, it means you need to be able to see anatomy that's near the fetus. The other scenario is that the fetus isn't in the imaging field of view. And if the fetus isn't in the image, the vast majority of the radiation that it's getting, almost all of it, is from internal scatter within the mother. That there's the primary X-ray beam interacting with the mother, and some of those X-rays are going to be scattered and reach the fetus. And whereas 40 years ago, the idea of off-axis radiation or the radiation being outside that collimated field of view, that was more of a concern. But with the modern technology, that really, it's just not, the amount of radiation of that sort of primary beam, so to speak, that's outside that collimated field of view is very, 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 very low. And it's just not worth the risk of potentially having that lead shielding in your image. And the caveat to that, and with the gonadal shielding as well, and I think that everybody recognizes that there are some instances in which the scientific evidence may be there, but for that patient at that particular time, shielding them is what is best for that patient from a psychological standpoint. And I use the example of a pregnant patient coming in to have with a suspected PE into the emergency department. They refuse to have any imaging done without fetal shielding. Now, what's most important for that patient is to be able to get an accurate diagnosis quickly. You're not going to sit there and say, let me tell you why our policy is to not shield pregnant patients. You can't have that conversation in that circumstance. And having the patient be willing to have that exam is really the main thing that you're the main clinical objective. And perhaps naively, I'm also somewhat optimistic that public opinion will also start to change. patients expect to be shielded because we've been doing it forever. And if the only reason that we keep doing it is because patients expect it, we're in this, I call it the cycle of radiophobia. But we've created this fear of something that most people in the medical community will agree that there really isn't a risk from. These very low doses of radiation, that there isn't a risk. And I've talked to many, many patients who are very concerned about radiation from imaging exams. And I'm a very strong believer that every patient should be making healthcare decisions that are best for them or their families. It's very frustrating isn't the right word. It's it concerns me, though, when those decisions are made on misinformation. And if somebody says, I spoke with a patient once, he had recently had surgery to fix an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And he had contacted me because his physician had requested, it was either a 3 or 6 month follow-up abdominal CT. Well, of course, he'd had imaging in the past. He didn't want to have the CT scan done. He was very concerned about the radiation. Now, this is a patient, they're looking for leaky vasculature. The risk to this patient from having an undiagnosed leaky vessel is orders of magnitude higher than the risk from the radiation. So I know this is a little bit tangential, but it all kind of ties together. We have to be aware of the risks of sort of perpetuating this misinformation to patients. And I feel very strongly about that. And I feel very strongly about patients getting access to accurate information.
No, I agree 100%. I don't think it's too tangential at all, because it is first and foremost in the minds of the patients and really the technologists. As far as the education of the patients, which will be another topic we'll get to, that's going to be an arduous process. I foresee posters and little cards you hand out and conversations being held and maybe even some media coverage. I don't know. It's going to be very hard to kind of unwind half a century of shielding our patients. So you mentioned a PE, and in my mind, that leads us to CAT scanning when you're looking for a PE. And there we're talking about shielding either, you know, around the patient or around the patient. Talk to the myth, because I've heard this before. I've heard technologists who say, if you shield a patient, the X-ray beam is going to, you know, maybe it's going to hit the back of the table behind the patient if they're laying supine, and then it's going to bounce up and hit the shield, and that's going to cause it to bounce back into the patient. And it's just going to go back and forth like a pinball, back and forth through the patient, and they're going to get more dose, because that's not really the physics of how that works, right?
No, and I'm glad that you brought that up. So one thing that lead is very, very good at, or these lead equivalent materials are used in lead aprons, they're very, very good at absorbing X-rays.
Right.
And so there's a very, very small fraction of that are sort of reflected off of the lead, but most of them, almost all of them, are absorbed by the X-ray. And it's actually interesting. So my full disclosure, my coworker slash husband, actually, this has come up often enough that he wrote a brief article for AJR that's, I think it's supposed to be published in their August issue, about the specific topic and discussing the physics of what happens when X-rays hit lead and why this concern about X-rays bouncing off of the lead aprons really isn't a concern. But that's a question that we've gotten a lot.
That's great timing for that article, because I do still hear that.
So how can someone get a hold of you to communicate or discuss any of these topics that we have gone over today?
Personal Twitter account, which is at RM Milman, RMMILMAN. And then for the AAPM work, there's actually an AAPM committee. It's AAPM Cares, and they have a Facebook and Twitter presence as well. AAPM CARES for Communicating Advances in Radiation Education for Shielding. But since nobody's going to remember the huge acronym, and I don't blame them.
I think what you've said is the anatomy you're trying to shield out field of view, the majority of the radiation exposure is due to scatter events within the patient. And if the shielding the shielding will do nothing to reduce the dose. But even from internal scatter, the dose to the anatomy outside of the imaging field of view falls off very, very rapidly. So in short, the risk of the lead entering the field of view far outweighs the benefit provided by the shielding, which of course is negligible. So I don't see how this doesn't apply to every modality really that uses x-rays. I mean, so we're saying CT probably shouldn't shield, IR, but now let's be clear that the employees are still shielding. We should still shield ourselves because, of course, we're around it every day in our jobs, right?
Absolutely. And there is, again, if you talk about risk benefit, there is the, I know this is not always true, but we have to work for the purpose of this conversation, we have to work from the assumption that the patient is deriving a benefit from that exam. Now, I don't want to get into a conversation imaging requests that aren't necessarily medically indicated. That's a whole different topic.
That never happens.
No, but the assumption is that a patient who is having an imaging exam is deriving a benefit from that exam. And from an occupational standpoint for radiation workers, they are not deriving a benefit from their radiation exposure. And so even, again, it kind of comes back to this risk-benefit conversation. I will say that actually I think that shielding in fluoroscopy and CT is even more problematic in X-ray because the places where you're using shielding, the exams for which you might be tempted to use shielding for CT, which are usually exams of the abdomen pelvis, whether it's gonadal shielding or fetal shielding, almost all of those exams these days use automatic exposure control or automatic tube current modulation. And some of those algorithms that are used to determine what MA to use are based on those scout images as well. And so it becomes problematic. And again, in fluoroscopy, every fluoroscopy system uses automatic brightness control, automatic dose control, whatever it may be. And there's just no getting around that. So I think it's actually even more problematic in fluoroscopy and CT than it is in general X-ray. But we do a lot more general X-ray than any other modality.
Yeah, we do. So the ASRT, of course, perfect timing. They came out yesterday. The title of their article is "The ASRT Board of Directors Provides Update on Gonadal and Fetal Shielding Position." They basically say that as of its June meeting, they met to discuss this, what they call emerging issue of ending the use of patient gonadal and fetal shielding during medical diagnostic X-ray procedures. And obviously, it's gotten a lot of attention. They state in their article, the issue has become top of mind within the radiologic technology community, as gonadal and fetal shielding are longstanding practices for facilities and radtechs. In addition, the community cannot take this issue lightly, as changing radiation safety best practices that have been in place for decades would require amendments to educational programs, state statutes, certifications, facility protocols, and of course, patient expectations. So they've kind of taken the statement of or the stance of, they flat out say the ASRT carefully reviewed the AAPM statement to evaluate how the findings would affect the 156,000 ASRT members and patient care. They heard from some members about concern, and they basically summarized by saying, at this time, the ASRT board cannot endorse the proposal to remove gonadal and fetal shielding. The board believes the community needs to conduct more research, review the science, and participate in further discussions to determine if the recommendation benefits patients and the RadTech community. Personally, I think we're already there, but I can see where they're asking for more science. And so I just wanted to point out the kind of the new stance from the ASRT. We hadn't really heard, and that's what a lot of the rad techs I've been talking to in the group's discussions was, you know, where is the ARRT on this? Where is the ASRT? Because clearly the AAPM and the ACR came out and said something. And one of our concerns from the rad tech perspective is, who's got our back if we start telling patients we're not going to shield anymore? And the AAPM was quick to say, you know, if the patient still wants it, go ahead and give it to them. But I think if we're acknowledging that the risks are higher with it, and then we go ahead and put it on them anyway because they ask for it, I don't. That concerns me on what our liability is there. If anything comes up down the road, you know, maybe related to that, what's our protection? So, and I don't know where that protection would come from. Would it be the ASRT taking a stance on it, you know, to do it or not to do it, or perhaps it's our own individual hospitals having a policy that say we aren't going to shield anymore. But I have that concern on behalf of the technologists out there that if we move to something so game-changing as to stop shielding the patients, we have to have something to kind of back us up on that. And then, you know, the whole aspect of how do we educate the patients on this? Do you have any thoughts on how would you educate a patient on something like that?
Well, a couple of things. So let's back up to something else that you had mentioned. I do want to point out that the APM statement really was APM saying, here's the science behind this topic. And we encourage folks to reconsider our practices based on this science. And APM is an organization of scientists. That's, you know, that's what we do. We're many of us, not all, but many of us are clinical scientists. And I think that, you know, that needs to be considered as well. I completely understand ASRT wanting to spend some time, more time looking at this. And while I think that the science is fairly clear and laid out and has been covered, I definitely think that we need to spend time, we as a community, ASRT, APM, rad techs, physicians, radiologists, everybody needs to really spend some time thinking about, okay, if there's the science, if we believe the science is there to support it, which I obviously do. And that's one thing that this, I mentioned AAPM CARES committee, and that's one thing that we're trying to address. And in their statement, ASRT mentions that they're working with AAPM on this. And we're really trying to engage, I say stakeholders, but a variety of people and say, hey, what are the things we need to consider? If we're going to do this and implement these things clinically, how do we need to go about doing that? What are the concerns of the ASRT community? I mean, that's a big one. And having an idea, nobody can address some of those, any of those concerns until we know what they are. And it's the same thing from patients. And at University of Colorado Hospital, we changed our hospital policy about patient shielding a little over a year ago. And that was, of course, the big concern was from technologists saying, oh my goodness, we're the ones who are going to have to answer all of these patients' questions. And I completely understand that. And I really did not want to say, yeah, we'll go figure it out. So I'd like to think that we've learned a few things along the way. At our facility, the technologists, when they bring a patient back and they ask for patient identifiers, they ask if they understand what exam they're having, they mention that we recently changed our policies so that we no longer shield patients. And we're very upfront about it, gives the patient an opportunity to ask questions. And the feedback that I've gotten from our techs anyway is that occasionally a patient will say, hey, well, why is that? And the patient, we have some verbiage that the techs have come up with that sort of almost canned responses that they can use for these scenarios so that they're not sitting there trying to fumble around and have a 5-minute conversation. And what they've decided is, you know, they have a couple of these canned responses, they use those. And if the patient still wants to be shielded, then they'll say, okay, we'll provide that to you. But our technologists have said that the vast majority of the time they use a couple canned responses and the patient says, oh, okay, that makes sense. And there's always on all of the information that we've developed that goes to patients, it all has what I have for years called the dial a physicist hotline. and all of our technologists and all of our schedulers know that they can give my office phone number to any of our patients who have additional questions. The hope is to try to relieve some of that pressure so that if they have a patient who really has a lot of questions, then we want to be able to talk to those patients anyway. If there are we do not want to be ignoring patient concerns. We really want to be able to address those and talk to those folks and make sure, again, that they're able to make a decision that they feel that's best for them. I know that there are other people within APM. Keith Strauss is a physicist who works at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and he's done something similar. And so he has more experience with the pediatric population. And admittedly, at University of Colorado Hospital, we don't get very many pediatric patients because there's a children's hospital just down the street. And so those are different conversations. But that is one thing. One of the first things that this AAPM committee is working on is FAQs. So, and there's a section specifically addressing medical physicists, health physicists, technologists, radiologists, healthcare workers, essentially. And then there's a separate section that specifically addresses patients. So frequently asked questions from patients. And a third that specifically addresses concerns from caregivers, patients, and guardians of pediatric patients. And the expectation is that this is that when this comes out, hopefully in the next couple of months, that this will be a first iteration. As soon as this is circulated, I fully anticipate that there will be additional questions that we haven't thought of and additional concerns that then the committee will have to go back and address those. But I do think that it is an iterative process, so to speak. But I think the alternative, which is to not do anything and to keep doing what we've always been doing, is really not a good solution either. So it's not ideal. And I know that there will be kind of hiccups along the way, and there will be things that we haven't thought of that will need to be addressed. But again, I think that it's important to, I think it's important to base clinical practice off of scientific evidence.
Absolutely. Another question that I see coming up is, what about just shielding extremities that are outside of the, you know, far away from the field of view?
So I'm glad that you brought that up. So that's a good question. And so when we first started talking about this, the University of Colorado Hospital is part of a much larger health system. And when we really started seriously discussing, okay, well, what are we going to do for our own hospital policies? We brought in the lead rad techs, the radiography managers, health physicists, and medical physicists from all of these other sites. And really discussed it. And one thing that people felt very strongly about was that whatever we were going to do, we needed to do it consistently. And the reason is, if you have a patient who comes in and has a chest x-ray and they're not shielded because there's a concern that the shielding would enter the field of view, but then they come back 2 weeks later for an x-ray of the hand and you provide shielding for them then, okay, the risk of the shield getting in the field of view is minimal or zero, but the benefit is also still zero. So what message? We're not giving a consistent message to our patients in this circumstance. And so it was decided early on at our own institution that, again, like I said, whatever we were going to do, we needed to do it consistently. And part of it was this effort to improve, I guess, improve isn't really the right word, to better represent what the radiation risk is, or in this case, what the radiation risk isn't.
So it's the consistency is the message of if you're shooting a hand or an elbow and you're shielding the thorax based on old standards, but then you're not in other circumstances, it's going to start confusing the patient.
Right, absolutely. Fetal and gonadal shielding are most common. And we know more about risks or lack of risks to the fetus or gonads from radiation. So with mammography, there are really two concerns when we're talking about radiation risk. One is dose to the thyroid. And there have been a number of studies that have shown that the dose of the thyroid during a mammogram is extremely, extremely low. And that the, again, sort of the same thing that we've talked about with gonadal and fetal shielding, that the risk of that thyroid shield getting in the image is fairly high. And of course, if you get an image and there's a big chunk of the thyroid shield in there, you have to retake the image. And that there really isn't any justification for doing it because the only radiation that's getting to the thyroid is the radiation that's being the very small that's being scattered from amount that's being scattered from the breast tissue. Right. The thyroid is not being exposed to the primary X-ray beam. So the exposure is in fact very, very low. Now, the other issue that comes up in terms of patient shielding, so for CT, sometimes we talk about bismuth breast shielding. And of course, patients are concerned about radiation risk for mammography, which ties into this whole thing again about patient perception of radiation risk. There are a number of studies that have that really suggest that the female breast tissue is there's an increased sensitivity to radiation between certain ages, between the ages of about 12, when a girl starts puberty, and the age of 30, or when they have their first child. So that radiosensitivity actually falls off drastically after a woman has her first child, or at the age of 30 if she doesn't have children. And it really has to do with all of the hypothesis is that it has to do with just developmental stages of breast tissue in women. But then if we think about the age of women who are getting mammograms, it is true that there are some women who are high risk who have mammograms before the age of 30, but that is not common. And of course, they have other risk factors that warrant them having mammograms at an earlier age. But regardless of what guidelines you're paying attention to, these women who are having mammograms starting at age 40 or 50, there really isn't evidence that the radiation from those mammograms is putting them at risk of developing breast cancer. And so I was diagnosed with locally advanced breast cancer when I was 36. And I've spoken since then to a lot of women who have had breast cancer. And even in women who have gone through breast cancer treatment, some of them are very, very hesitant to have follow-up mammograms because they're afraid of the radiation risk. And that, to me, is really the medical community doing a disservice to these patients if we're not trying to sort of set the record straight on what the radiation risk actually is. Now, we're never going to be able to say that the risk from any of these things is zero because it is scientifically impossible to prove that something is entirely safe. It's never going to happen. But we can say that the risk is very, very, very low or non-existent. We don't know. There may be some very small risk, but if there's a risk, it's very, very low. But I think that that's, again, part of my personal motivation is that it's really disheartening to see patients who refuse to have a medically indicated imaging exam because they're way overestimating what the risk is from radiation. And it's a difficult thing to try to combat, but I think that to completely ignore the issue and say, okay, well, that's a really difficult task, or we're never going to be able to convince the public that, you know, of anything differently than sort of the current mindset, I think is not the way to go. You're never going to be able to, you can provide 30 plus references. You can provide all the scientific evidence you want. And it doesn't mean that everybody's going to agree with you. And it's not about people agreeing with me or people agreeing with AAPM. It's about honestly trying to do what we think is best for patients to improve patient care in the long run, recognizing that there may be some growing pains in some ways along the way. But I also think it's really important that we keep having these conversations, that we have to communicate about, okay, well, what works and what doesn't. And we've done that within our own facility, that I've had rad techs come back and say, you know, when I have this conversation with patients, it seems to resonate. And other times it just seems to make things worse. For example, we're not going to go through. And if it, we're not going to go up to a patient who says, hey, I'm concerned that you're not shielding me or that you're not shielding my son, and say, don't worry about it. And that's not an effective way to communicate that. But there are other ways that are more effective. And some of that is just, unfortunately, trial and error. And I think that if we can go through that process as a community, and if the rad techs and the medical physicists and the health physicists and the radiologists and referring physicians, if everybody's willing to have an open dialogue about this, then it'll be better. It'll be a better sort of product overall. Product isn't the right word, but we'll be able to better serve our patients. And I think there'll be better understanding of all of those things, because no one person or group really has, I don't want to say really has the full picture. And I really think that this sort of thing requires input and communication between all of the interested parties.
And I don't feel we really have a place to get all those people on the same page. You know, like I kind of found you through Reddit, but yet I'm communicating with a lot of techs through Facebook. And that make me wonder, is anybody going to speak about this? We have our annual AHRA convention coming up actually this month, later on in Denver, I believe. And that's the, you know, Association of Radiology Management. I hope somebody's going to speak to this at that, because clearly this has everyone's attention. There are a lot of people. When I reached out to my system physicist and brought up this topic, they were fully aware. And in fact, his predecessor had actually said we should stop shielding in one of our meetings. And when I took that back to my imaging department, it got the same kind of response. What do you mean stop shielding? And that we've always shielded. That doesn't make any sense at all. So this is not a new concept to most of us in the field, but I think you're accurate in saying, as people of science and of people that should be using critical thinking skills, we should always be evaluating our technologies and our best practices to make sure we're continuing to offer what's best practice for our patients. And this to me just is sending a pretty clear signal that it's time to stop and evaluate our current practice of shielding. When the studies start to show that anatomy is getting clipped and repeats are happening, and we all know that our machines are putting out less dose and that we're able to get better images, and it's all just kind of coming together to say it's time to reevaluate the current practice. But it is such a large culture change. It will take a lot of education, both to the healthcare professionals and the public. And we'll have to have plenty of science to back it. I think we're headed the right direction. So I hope that everyone can find a way to dialogue about this so that we can continue to work collaboratively together.
So I just will reiterate, I know that you mentioned there not being sort of a central area to discuss some of these things. And that's one thing that that AAPM, so I chair the AAPM multi-society committee on this, okay. The AAPM cares, and there is representation from a number of professional societies, and so that we can have these conversations. And so I'm more than happy to speak about this, because it's something that I care a lot about. I care a lot about patient safety. And so I would encourage folks who are interested to sort of follow the AAPM cares on social media. It's fairly new, but we plan on having some, like I said, FAQs and some other materials out in the next 2-3 months. And if there's any organization that wants somebody from that group to come and speak at a meeting, whether it's a state rad tech meeting, or like you had mentioned for healthcare radiology managers, you know, reach out, and we're happy to do that, because a large part of this is having those conversations.
No, so I totally get it. You guys are trying to get your hands around having the FAQs out there, and it's great if you guys are willing to come to our state conferences and nationwide conference. That's even better. I don't think I have said in this whole interview what the AAPM stands for. So it is
American Association of Physicists in Medicine.
Tell me about your job as a medical physicist.
So one big thing that medical physicists do is we're sort of, I don't know the right word for it. We're supposed to be independent assessors of whether or not imaging equipment is working the way it should. And that goes from evaluations of image quality to radiation output. And also that extends to, we work very closely with radiologists and other physicians to help optimize the use of radiation and optimizing image quality. And so I know that some rad techs may be very familiar with who their local physicist is. Others, the physicist may come in under the cloak of night to do a lot of their work. Personally, I actually try to do as much as I can and have as much interaction from our rad techs and nursing staff and physicians as possible, partly so that we can have these sorts of conversations, but also partly because I learn a lot from them. And even last week, I was testing an X-ray system and we were talking about their regulations about the collimated X-ray field is supposed to, it should not exceed the image detector area. And this rad tech explained to me that there are instances where really that's a disadvantage. And for example, the example he gave was doing exams of longer bones that they may fit diagonally across the detector, but not across. And this was a square digital detector that we were working with. And he pointed out that if you can rotate that X-ray field, then yes, there may be the ability to have it be larger than the detector area, but you can get that sort of diagonally positioned image. I had never thought of that. And it makes perfect sense. And I thought, so maybe that's actually a reason to advocate changing that regulation. If we can say, hey, look, there are instances where it makes more sense to be able to get this anatomy in one shot than having to break it up over two images, then yeah, that makes sense. But those are the sorts of things that I, as a medical physicist, unless I am having those conversations, I never would have thought of.
And that's a great example of the collaboration that needs to occur. So is there one central place we can all go to talk about this that you have found? Is there a forum somewhere? I mean, I haven't seen one good central location.
So the answer is no. I would say that that AAPM CARES site is probably the best bet. And it's affiliated with AAPM, but it is seen by, like I said, that committee has representation. There are radiologists and health physicists and technologists and a wide variety of folks who are participating in that. And anything that's posted there, since I chair that committee, I'm more than happy to take back to the rest of the committee and try to address.
So I'm thinking maybe, I wonder if I can somehow facilitate a live, I don't know, a Facebook, not meet and greet, but a live feed where some of you from the AAPM can, be on a live feed where people can join in and ask questions and get feedback in real time, kind of like that, because there doesn't seem to be a place we can go, which was why I wanted to have this interview, was to get some information out there. But maybe if I can ask if they're interested in that, maybe I could do a Facebook Live. It would allow, I've seen where multiple people have been able to come together and communicate, even if it's just, where we stream something and people just ask questions and you can see the questions and you can speak to the questions.
Absolutely.
Maybe something like that would be beneficial. So let me know what you find out on that. I'd be happy to try and put something like that together.
I think that's an excellent suggestion though, and we should be able to facilitate that. I will say that the AAPM national meeting actually starts next week and goes to the following week. So it may not happen until after that.
That's fine.
because most of us will be there. But we definitely should be able to put something together.
So I just wanted to thank you for taking the time out. We've gone a good hour and 11 minutes. That's time out of your day you donated to help us understand kind of what's going on from a physicist's perspective. You certainly have impressive credentials. I have no doubt you're a subject matter expert in your field. So I look forward to taking this message back out to the radiologic technologist community and sharing it and seeing how we can better be collaborative on this whole issue. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
See you later.
I just realized everybody is here to party.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Radiologic Technologist Podcast. Please visit our sponsors and visit our website at theradiologictechnologist.com, where we post all podcasts and welcome your comments.